This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me in studio is Jason DeSanto. He's a senior lecturer at Northwestern Pritzker School of Law, specializing in, the polite term would be maybe you're a specialist in political rhetoric?
Yeah, political rhetoric, public advocacy.
I mean, rhetoric being the polite term.
That's more than polite. That's Sunday morning polite.
Yeah, that's, that's so we don't lose our license here at the radio station.
Is that the bar we're trying to jump over?
Do not make me seek out the panic button, okay? Please, okay. Please. Jason, thank you for joining me. I wanted to start our discussion of the round two tonight debate in Detroit of the Democratic candidates. I wanted to start that by playing what I thought were two of the more significant jousts that were raised there. So I guess one of the best smackdowns was from Elizabeth Warren to former Congressman John Delaney. Delaney, who seemed to get an inordinate amount of airtime only because he was an instigator, I think. Delaney complained that the progressives were making promises that they couldn't fill.
So I think Democrats win when we run on real solutions, not impossible promises. When we run on things that are workable, not fairy tale economics.
Senator Warren,
do it.
You know, I don't understand why anybody goes to all the trouble of running for president of the United States just to talk about what we really can't do and shouldn't fight for.
So there was that smackdown. And then for his part, I thought Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders offered a pithy response when Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan questioned Sanders' provision that private health insurance would go away under Sanders' Medicare for All plan.
This plan that's being offered by Senator Warren and Senator Sanders will tell those union members who gave away wages in order to get good health care, that they're going to lose their health care because Washington's going to come in and tell them they got a better plan.
Two things. They will be better because Medicare for All is comprehensive. It covers all health care needs for senior citizens. It will finally include dental care, hearing aids, and eyeglasses.
But you don't know.
Second of all.
You don't know that,
second
Bernie.
Of all.
We'll come to you in a second,
I do know, and I wrote the damn bill.
I wrote the damn bill.
That's Bernie in a nutshell.
Yes, right it there. Is. I wrote the damn bill. I remember someone, I think it was Hickenlooper talking about being a mayor and Bernie. I was a mayor, too.
Remember in 2015, on the eve of the 2016 election, when he and Hillary Clinton were going at it, and he announced, I'm sick of hearing about your damn emails.
That's right.
Via Brooklyn.
That's right. So, obviously the dynamic of the progressive versus moderate, which I never thought of moderate as a term you would use to talk about Democratic candidates.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think I'd ever written the term, a moderate Democrat before. I mean, it was the old days, it was moderate Republicans, you would talk about as moderates. But truly, there is this differentiation in the Democratic Party.
Well, because it's a party that actually features some differences in thought. Okay? Not to be too reductive about it. This is a debate that they're going to be having all the way through the fall and into the early part of next year. But you're right, Rick. I mean, these are different gradations of how do we do better than Obamacare, which suddenly has become not only the ground floor of what health care should be, but in some ways the candidates are arguing about the next iteration of health care reform without really talking about what Obamacare does well, did well. It's sort of right on to what the solution is. And to me, as part of the policy debate, that's a little bit of the problem. Mm-hmm. Because they're not really engaging on exactly which problems they want to solve for whom. Some of them are talking about covering the uninsured, which was a major part of the Obamacare debate. Some of them implicitly, I think, are focusing on the degree to which healthcare costs too much. I have not heard really one good answer from one candidate about these are the two or three problems we need to solve. Obamacare got us to here. Here's what's not working about that, and here's how we do better. Yeah, instead, we're all sort of engaging on how does this simply look great?
Or into hyperspace about Medicare for all, and that will take care of every problem, again, without identifying the problem. I thought one of the interesting things was, here again, kind of this, as I referred to it earlier, is the Democrats in a circle kind of thing. But it was not bringing up the thing that Republicans have been facing, which is pre-existing conditions, and not going after Republicans on that issue.
It's come up as a counter in some of the arguments, but it's never the lead argument.
It's never projected.
Yeah, and I think that goes back to the point I was making a minute ago. The 2018 midterms were largely won in a lot of swing districts in the House of Representatives races because of the issue of pre-existing conditions. That would be something I would want to identify right away in terms of laying out what the problem is, then talk about the number of uninsured, then talk about maybe the cost of prescription drugs, but I'd be very clear about those things, and then talk about how this plan gets us a little further along the way. Otherwise, I think it's contextually a little difficult for people who are not, for example, in the Twitterverse, to kind of figure out.
Which is most people.
Well, and here's the point to me, Rick, is that some people would say, well, Medicare for All sounds very radical, and it's going to be cast as very radical. Well, maybe not. I mean, maybe we're at a point with the healthcare system where it isn't. I think there are people who are willing to listen to common sense arguments about what should come next if they understand what it is that you are trying to actually solve and whether that particular problem resonates with them. And until you do that, you're missing opportunities to actually move people who might otherwise come to your side.
Well, that's why I think it's interesting in the issue of like private insurance, and not that anybody's a big fan of insurance companies or that kind of thing. But, you know, there are those who like the insurance that they have. The question not being asked is, for your private insurance, how much have your premiums increased over the years? And what could you get in a, quote, Medicare for All system that would provide essentially equivalent coverage and net out the cost of whatever the increased taxes would be for that coverage?
Yes.
Am I being too common sense here?
No, I think that's true. And maybe someone could make the point that if we didn't have 10 candidates on stage, maybe it would be more likely to get into that kind of a discussion. But I think the other piece of it, Rick, is not only the cost, but also I don't think people necessarily love their insurance companies. I mean, they like when their deductible doesn't bankrupt them.
Right.
But they like their doctors. They like the medical care they get. I mean, to me, the argument about private insurance is partially about payment, but it's also a proxy for, I don't want to get thrown into a program where I'm going to have to wait longer for an appointment to see somebody I don't want to see. Now there, of course, now there's an impediment, I think, for Democrats who are making the argument for Medicare for All, because they run right into Obama's promise that if you like your doctor,
I was just going to say, right? That's the famous line.
Right. So now rhetorically, that's the next hurdle that somebody has to get over. But to me, this all starts with first and foremost pointing people to what doesn't work. And that begins to focus listeners on, okay, now how do we make it better?
I mean, because we're not really at least I'm not hearing it is, you know, let's fix it. Which used to be, you know, even among supporters, those in Congress, the Democrats that voted for it, was, yeah, we know it's not the end all, and we'll just keep fixing it. But I'm not hearing, I mean, fix maybe sounds not progressive enough.
Well, there is a point regarding the argumentation there, which is that Warren clip you played, the first one, the one with John Delaney, is a prime example of these healthcare debates become policy debates. The first night of the debates were largely about the big questions, the macro question. Are we going to have private health insurance preserved or not? The second night of debates was about more of the micro, which is here's what's in my plan versus your plan. But to my ear, they're not just debating about healthcare. They're actually debating about a view of the world and about whether you are somebody who's for bold action or not for bold action. Warren's response to Delaney why do you bother to run?
Right.
Unless you're willing to do something.
Big things.
Is really a way to take the healthcare argument and make it a vehicle for a much larger argument about the nature of the candidate. I'm bold. You're not. And in that way, the policy arguments begins to fade away a little bit and becomes much more about the trust level we have with the candidate. I don't think that's inappropriate. I think candidates do that all the time quite properly. But that is a way in which, again, we move a little bit further away from the nature of the problem we're trying to solve and a little bit more towards either what our solutions are or who the candidate
is. Or character definition.
Yeah, character definition, right.
I mean, and in fact, I thought it was interesting, too, with Kamala Harris kind of got lost in the weeds of her own plan at one point.
So we were here a few weeks ago talking about the first debate.
Right.
And in that debate, she was masterful. I thought this week she was miserable. She got lost in the details of her own plan. She looked exasperated constantly. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, you have to know that if you're rising, you're going to be the one that's going to be the center of attacks. And so the more prepared you are for those attacks,
sure,
those become opportunities, every one of them. And we saw a number of candidates who actually did well by being attacked. As wobbly as he was, I thought Biden reinforced himself in his position a little bit by being relatively competent in handling attacks. I thought other people like Julian Castro, Cory Booker, were attacked. Castro on what his position on immigration was when he was in the Obama candidate cabinet. Booker on his record as mayor of Newark. They were both prepared, and they both handled those well. And as a result, they looked stronger. They were more likable. Harris didn't do that. I mean, she really looked peeved most of the evening. And that's just not the demeanor you want, and the substance of the answer, as you alluded to, at least on healthcare, was not particularly strong. She never did really counter any of the arguments about her record on criminal justice.
Not at all.
Which has been a subject for months and months and months and months.
And
you have to know that's coming.
You just took the words right out of my mouth. Is that has been a demonstrated case of baggage for her candidacy. You know what's going to come out of it. You know what your record is. What is your defense?
Well, her response was, I was in there and I did the work. I think the argument is, it's much harder when you're actually in a leadership position. The rest of you are throwing stones. I was actually in the middle of it. But the problem with that is, she never really confronted any of the individual claims that were made by Biden or by Tulsi Gabbard about her record. And I think when you don't pick out at least one point that you can rebut and then pivot to some higher ground or to some other point, it begins to look a little slippery. And you know, one of the criticisms of her candidacy is that it's essentially about nothing. It doesn't have a core message. And if that's the overriding narrative about your campaign, anything you do that begins to play into that, whether by commission or omission, really works against your overall campaign. And it certainly works against your performance for one evening. And I thought that's what happened to her the other night.
She just didn't look comfortable.
No.
I didn't see any. And who knows? Maybe it was Joe Biden walking out and saying, you know, take it easy on me, kid.
I highly doubt that is what it did. And the other thing, too, is, too, she had a kind of a dormant campaign for a long time and then did really well in that first debate. So it could just as well be that she has a bad debate and then comes back really well in September. These things go up, they go down, there are actions, there are reactions, so we shouldn't read too much into it. But if you're asking me empirically how it looked and how she did, that was not a good performance.
We're speaking with Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin on this beautiful Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here in the Allstate Skyline studio by Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer at the Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. We're talking about some of the takeaways from round two of the two-night Democratic debate. Too damn long.
It was a long night.
Two nights.
Yeah, two long nights. I thought once you got into the 9:30 component of the 7 to 10. I was fooled actually because I thought they were finishing.
We were just talking about this off air. We were figuring this will be nice because it's on an hour earlier than usual. So it'll be 7 to 9 and then it'll be done. Except then it came to 9 o'clock and they're still going. And then it came to 9:30 and they were still going.
Yeah, and nobody needs to see Bill de Blasio in hour 3. So a little goes a long way, I think, is the watchword there.
Do you think we're now at the point of these two rounds of debates where maybe not certainly not voter attitudes have set in, but certainly among funding sources have set in that some of these candidates are going to find out that there's nobody to punch their ticket, and we start seeing some folks drop out.
So you have a combination of two things that are going on. One is the requirements to get on the debate stage in September are higher.
Right.
So for the first
more
debates,
individual donors and a higher polling showing than 1%.
Yep, we move from 65,000 donors to 130,000 donors. We move from 1% in the polls to 2% in the polls, and rather than an either or between right. donors and polling position, it's both. So this is a much higher threshold. And so I think at this point, about 10 candidates have or shortly will pass those thresholds. So that will cut the number down. And then in turn, when that happens, that'll be in September. If they're not on the debate stage in September, what's going to happen is they're going to lose visibility. And so when you have a fundraising deadline for the quarter at the end of September,
right.
some people just are not going to be able to push over that line what they need to, and that will be the point at which some of them are going to turn out the lights.
What about this month, though? Does anybody get out this month?
Maybe.
I mean,
but I don't know.
I still think it's too early.
Yeah, and I don't know until you get to that fundraising deadline or the next debate deadline, which is August 28th, to get into the September debates. I don't know whether there's a real need to do that. So if you're asking me about August, I'd suspect probably not. If you're asking me about September, yes. If you're asking me about October, definitely.
Well, August, it's state fair time in Iowa. So, you know, everybody's got to go visit the stage in Des Moines and get whatever volume you can out of it.
Yes, yes. Watch for my book on that time of year. It's called A Time for Funnel Cakes. And it's all about state fair time.
All kinds of deep fried recipes.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah.
Well, then you should join me in Springfield in a couple of weeks.
I'm going to let you go, and then I'm going to look for your reviews.
No, you don't want to see my review. I'm not a big state fair fan.
That's unfortunate.
Well, I'm not going to get into it.
Okay.
I appreciate those that love the state fair.
Yeah.
And for those who like a really good state fair, I would send them to Wisconsin instead of the Illinois State Fair, which may sound unpatriotic, but it's a better state fair.
How about DuQuoin? That is a lovely state fair.
That is a throwback state fair, actually.
Yeah.
And obviously no Confederate Railroad will be performing there. You know what I'm referring to.
Yeah, I do.
That they were supposed to play.
Yeah.
And then
they're not playing there
either. They got canceled by the state. And now a local Harley dealer apparently is having them perform.
Okay.
So, but we digress.
Okay. Yes.
Mayor Pete.
Yes.
It speaks of substance. Is he making enough of a breakthrough?
He's maintaining his position. He's reinforcing himself with people who already like him. But yeah, there's room for him to continue to improve his performances and also ascend in the polls as well. And I think my argument there would be he will do better when the field winnows a little bit and the contrasts he can draw are a little bit more dramatic in terms of the generational arguments and also some of the more hard-edged arguments. To me, as a debater, you're right. I think he makes relatively substantive arguments. I think his talent is in being able to speak a language of values and common sense and reframing of issues in ways that Democrats often don't. He gave an answer in a debate a couple of weeks ago about education. And he said, one of the things we have to do is we have to make sure that it is just as viable for people not to go to college as to go to college and then be able to contribute to their communities and Little League and their churches. There's just a comfort level there at being able to use those indicators of Midwestern small town life. He comes by it honestly, having been a mayor. And that is always impressive. I think he was reaching a little bit in some of his performance this past week. There are two examples. One, his answer on race is still, in contrast to the kind of answer I just described, highly mechanical.
Right.
And very much, I have to hit two or three
calculated
talking points. Mm-hmm. It's not natural. He still, I can tell in watching him, looks like he is on unsteady ground there. Secondly, he was trying to draw a contrast with his military service and Trump. I could tell in watching it that that was a goal because he took a question about climate change and pivoted it all the way to, it doesn't matter what our positions are on climate change unless we can beat Trump. Let me tell you how I'm going to beat Trump, and I'm going to beat Trump by being on the stage next to somebody who shirked military service while I served in the military. Now, that's a good way of contrasting yourself, but it's a long way from a question on climate change. That seemed forced.
Jason DeSanto, senior lecturer, Northwestern Pritzker School of Law. Thank you so much for joining me, and hope to have you again in September.
Thanks, Rick.
For the next debate.
I look forward to it.
I got you signed up right now.
It just happened.
Thank you so much.
All right, man.